This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
It is 7:13. I knew what I wanted to do when I was 4 years old, and I wound up doing it. And our next guest apparently knew what he wanted to do as a young man, and he wound up doing it as well. And with that, we welcome in the newly minted director of the U.S. Mint, Paul Hollis. Good morning, Paul. How are you?
Oh, good morning. Thank you. I'm doing great.
I'm guessing I'm not the first one to say newly minted head of the Mint, am I?
Actually, you're the first one that has said that, and then the cents and the penny, those comments seem to be flowing creatively as well. So, anyway.
Tell me a little bit about yourself. You grew up here?
Yeah, I did, in Metairie. I mean, I was a strange kid. A measuring stick to determine, you know, if you were going to be my buddy or not was, you know, I showed you a collection of coins, and, mm-hmm. you know, you either looked at it and ignored it like most people, or you looked at it and thought, wow, that's really cool. But I have two brothers, and they both thought, man, our little brother's weird, you know, but I've always loved coins.
At what point in your life that you were, I remember 4 years old deciding what I wanted to do, or realizing what I wanted to do. And I just wonder, at what point do you remember an age where, for whatever reason, something happened, an aunt gave you a coin or something fascinated you by them?
Yeah, my earliest memory, believe it or not, my grandma from Monroe, Louisiana, we used to go up there, spend a lot of time during holidays. She had a peace dollar that was made right after World War I that she had saved, offered it to my two brothers. They weren't really interested, showed it to me. And Tommy, I just wouldn't let that coin go. I thought it was the coolest thing in the world.
And how old were you, Paul?
I was 7 at the time.
That's awesome, man. That's great. So how do you go from there to running the U.S. Mint?
Well, it's so strange. I just followed all the cues in my life. I'm sure remember my dad. He served in the state Senate for 26 years. Sure. He inspired a great deal of, he just inspired me in every way imaginable. When I graduated from LSU, I went to work for a big coin company in Louisiana. And then there was an opportunity to run for the state house seat, and I ran for that, and I served for 12 years. Meanwhile, I continued to trade, you know, a bunch of collectible coins. About 15 years ago, we exhibited one of the coolest coins that was ever made in New Orleans, and we exhibited at the New Orleans Mint. And so I guess my point to you is I've had a nice little mix of public service and then doing something very unusual. A lot of people in politics are lawyers or consultants or CPAs, but I'm probably the only person that ever traded collectible coins. But fast forward to last year, 2024, even before the election, I expressed some interest in being the U.S. Mint director. I'm obviously thrilled. Louisiana, as you know, has so many high-ranking federal officials. I mean, at the very top on the House side is my friend, Speaker Johnson, and then, of course, Steve Scalise, serving as House Majority Leader. And with the federal power that Louisiana has, we're punching way, way above our weight. I thought this just might happen, and here we are a year or so later, and it's happening.
That's awesome. You are an affirmed numismatist. Am I pronouncing it right?
Yeah.
But I don't think there's any need to bring religion into it. Paul, I'm just kidding. No, tell people what that is. It's a coin collector, right?
You got it. Yeah, people in this industry can't even say correct, so you did real well. I'm a professional numismatist, and it's a bigger industry than what a lot of people think, but I've been trading collectible coins since I was really young, and professionally that's all that I've done. And the historic aspect of this appointment is twofold. First time somebody from Louisiana has served in this capacity. There's only been 40 U.S. Mint directors up until this point, going back to 1792. So that surprises a lot of people. Fewer Mint directors confirmed than presidents of the United States.
Wow.
And so, I'll be number 41. I intend to take my swearing in on Monday. The president actually just 2 days ago on Wednesday sign the commission. So even after it goes through the confirmation process, you still have to have your official commission signed. And that was just done 2 days ago. And then I'll look forward to taking office and then hopefully having a more formal swearing in when a lot of people from Louisiana go to D.C. Mardi Gras. And in my world of fantasy, Speaker Mike Johnson will swear me in, and hopefully we can work out the details to have that done. And it is historic. And the other reason is not just the first time someone from Louisiana, but somebody that truly has a lifelong understanding of coins and appreciation for their history to serve in this role. So the numismatic world is obviously excited to have someone especially serving with America 250 this year. You know, that's historic in itself.
So what is the deal with the penny? Is it here? Well, is it gone? Is it not? I'm confused about that.
There'll be pennies around forever because, you know, over half a trillion have been struck since they were first produced back in 1793. But as you know, over the last 10 years, the cost of production, the cost of, you know, the metallic contents used, zinc and to a smaller degree, copper, have become so expensive. The cost of producing them has made it, you know, I think, unnecessary. And I was happy to see the administration, not surprised to have them. There was no mint director in place at that time, but the administration, as I appreciate, said, let's no longer do this. And it says save taxpayers somewhere in the neighborhood of $75 million. And I think that's significant. So there'll be rounding that's going to be done. And other nations, Tommy, they've done it. So we're not the first nation to do it, recognizing inflation over time.
So let me take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back, because I want to talk about with electronic currency and so forth. What does the future of coins look like? And is there a possibility of my dad, you know, as you say this, Paul, my dad used to collect coins, and I realized he passed away maybe 20 years ago, and I got a box of coins in my attic somewhere that I just put up there. They might have something valuable in it. Hell, that could be my retirement up in my attic. I didn't even realize that. I don't know.
Be.
Yeah, I'm going to have a numismatist look at it.
There you go.
720 more with the newly appointed director of the U.S. Mint, Paul Hollis, when we come back. First one from Louisiana, 720, traffic now, WWL. 724 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Paul Hollis, director of the U.S. Mint. There have been less directors of the U.S. Mint than there have been presidents. Paul, how long do you serve? How long's your term? Until death?
No, it's not. It's a five-year term, but you really serve at the pleasure of the president, the person that appoints you for the position and then confirmed by the Senate, which fortunately has all been done.
So your favorite coin, as I understand it, is a 1925 U.S. Indian headquarter nickel. That's your lucky coin?
$2.50 gold coin. Yeah, the coin my grandma gave me was a peace dollar, so that was silver. But when she died, and that was 20 some odd years ago, she had worn around her neck in a bezel a $2.50 gold coin that she had saved through the Great Depression. And so after she died, I had that put in a little acrylic holder, and then I have her name on it and the date of her lifetime. And so it's the coin that I carry with me during every major life event.
So it's in an acrylic holder. You're not going to put that in a vending machine. Have you ever done that? Have you ever had a have you ever had a coin in your pocket that you mistakenly put in a vending machine?
No, because, Tommy, most of the nice coins are put in acrylic holders. They're slabs or third-party graded. That's a thing that they started doing in the 1980s. So the odds of that. I mean, you probably remember in the 70s and 80s, people would spend silver coins accidentally, but most of those have been taken now from change. But you'd mentioned, you know, the stuff in your attic.
Yeah.
Your dad might add a bunch of silver coins.
I'm sure he does. And I'll tell you something else that I'll bet he has is a lot of silver dollars to go back to the day.
And you've seen the price of silver spike. I mean, silver's now like $70 an ounce. Gold's $4,300, and price has moved up crazy.
All right, Tim, play some music. I'm going to my attic to see what I have in there, and I'll let me. What makes the coin? I remember, you know, my dad, something about the coins had to not be touched or something like that, mint condition. What is that?
Yeah, I mean, most coins go into circulation, but the really rare coins are the ones that have been preserved over time. And so many people think that when you find a nice coin, you want to clean it. That's the last thing you want to do. The really high-quality, valuable coins are the ones that have defied time with incredible states of preservation. So if you have a coin that has any wear on it, probably not terribly valuable, but that's not always the case. It could be a very rare date. But the coins that collectors cherish are coins that are, you know, really old, but in a real high state of preservation.
So a little bit of what you do is going to be day-to-day, but you also are looking 5 and 10 years down the line as the director of the Mint. What is on your radar, Paul, for 5 and 10 years down the line as far as coins go?
There was a time, Tommy, the Mint used to turn over. I mean, it's funded by itself, its operations. They sell coins to the Federal Reserve banks, and so and they sell it at face value. So if you make your money on seniorage, which is the difference between production cost and the actual face value, that's how you turn over a significant number of dollars to Treasury. There have been times in the past they've turned over $500 or $600 million a year, and in recent memory, it hasn't been anywhere near that. So number one, I'd like to strive for efficiency so that we can turn over greater dollars to Treasury. But number two, to create a bunch of collectors like me that have an appreciation for history. And there's no better time for me to be at the helm here, because with America 250, a bunch of new coin designs are going to come out. And each one of them, they're like a small, you know, metallic canvas for America's brand. And you had mentioned your dad's coins. There are coins that great-great-great-grandfather's coins. My point is coins can last hundreds or even 1,000 or more years. And so the fact that America strikes, you know, billions of coins every year, that's our brand. That's something that ties us all together. And they're always very thoughtful. It's not easy to come up with the design on the obverse, the reverse of a coin. But my point is we've been doing it since 1792. And some of these coins are still around today, hundreds of years later. So I go at the helm of the United States Mint, recognizing there's thousands of employees that are committed to this task, and that we become history in your hands that we create for Americans, with the ultimate goal being to provide coins for commerce, but in that same space is the recognition that, you know, we create history.
You have any idea what's waiting for you or not?
An idea, yeah, because I've, you know, been friends with former directors, and I've watched the decision making that they've made. But there's so many professionals in that space that have served 20, 30 years. So I'll have a lot of experts weighing in on, you know, whatever major decisions are going to be at hand in the near future.
And I guess you would be the guy or committee who approves the artwork before a coin is struck.
It's pretty complicated, but fortunately, I think if you're going to pin it down to one individual, although that's tough in itself, Secretary of the Treasury Scott Bessent would be the person whose final say, but there's different entities that weigh in, the Commission of Fine Arts, and you've got the Citizens Coinage Advisory Committee, and there's a number of different members to each one of those groups, and you can imagine it is a process that's purposely not designed so one person says, hey, this is what we're going to do. They're very thoughtful, and a lot goes into it.
I just wanted to know where to send the selfie of myself. But look, Paul, put it on a, please. I'm not a handsome guy. Put it on a very small coin, okay? On a dime.
High profile. How's
something
that?
Small,
high,
yeah.
Profile. You can get away with a lot there.
Very so. Small. Thank you, sir. Right. Appreciate it. Good luck, Paul. Nice talking
pleasure.
To you. You bet.
You.
Paul Hollis, new director of the U.S. Mint. 7:30, we'll talk to Joe Geruso when we come back on WWL. 7:43, 17 till 8. Defiant until the end is maybe a good thing if you're fighting for a noble goal, but defiant for defiant's sake, I don't know if that's a good look for LaToya Cantrell. And, you know, I would remind her that last impressions are lasting impressions. However, it's probably too late for that. Joe Geruso joins us now, New Orleans City Council member and soon-to-be New Orleans CAO. How you doing, Joe?
Good morning. I'm well. How are you?
I'm all right, sir. Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year, Tommy.
So let's talk about what the mayor did with vetoing. What did she do?
So we filed an ordinance that simply said, hey, look, if you have new revenue coming in, can we just sort of put it on the side for the new administration, new council to sort through it? And, Tommy, the main reason for doing that is, in addition to having to fund all necessary city operations, making sure everything is taken care of, remember, the city has this obligation to pay back this thing called the RAN, the Revenue Anticipatory Note. So all the council is trying to do is make sure that there's money that's being set aside, that we're paying vendors correctly, that things are being done well, and that there's management going in. And I think the other thing, at least I was thinking, I always hesitate to speak for my other colleagues, but for me, it's a, hey, this is a two-week thing. Mm-hmm. This isn't something to put the handcuff on the mayor while she has a ton of runway in front of her to prevent her from doing her job. But this is a, all right, like, people lose line of sight at the end of anything. It's easy to get distracted. Or potentially people just make a mistake. They put money and let it walk out the door without thinking about the long-term implications. And so this is just a way to try and be responsible. And so, as you pointed out in your question, the mayor vetoed that ordinance that I think all seven members of the council were co-authors of.
So what happens with an override?
Well, the override would be on Thursday at our council meeting, where it would prevent the administration from spending money from, I guess, Thursday the 8th going forward. So, and again, I hate things. Hate is too strong a word. I tend not to like to do things that tend to be symbolic in nature. But at the same time, before the new administration starts, you still do have Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and some time Monday before the inauguration. So it just puts stop on spending money unnecessarily. And just to make sure, again, as the new administration comes in and the council, they have a clear ability to look at what's going on, understand what's happening, and prevent money from walking out the door without knowing what's happening and where it's going.
Let me put it in layman's terms. A hole has been dug, and what you're doing is taking away the keys to the excavator to make sure that the digging stops, because you've already taken out this loan and you're responsible for that, right? And that's got to be paid back?
That's got to be paid back this year.
And you have to have council meetings every week, correct?
Have to have council meetings every week so we can make payroll, so we can use draw down from the loan to pay the city employees every single week.
So you talk about runway. I don't. Is this going to really change anything the mayor would do, or
given
the financial situation the city's in, or should have done?
Well, I think the issue is it likely for anything major to change? No, but does it put to use your analogy? Does it take away the keys so that way something doesn't get dug that isn't supposed to? Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
And I think that's the whole point of this, is that there probably isn't a lot that can happen if we're being really candid about it. But at the same time, there is a possibility. And so let's just forestall that possibility. Let's just take a deep breath. And again, I'm cognizant of the fact that the new administration doesn't start until the 12th, but there's still a week between now and then, and let's let those folks get in, make decisions, and do it clear-eyed with as much information and as much backing as possible.
I think the mayor is taking this personally and looking at it as a political payback, when in fact the council is only doing what is their fiduciary duty to do. Is that accurate?
Yeah, unfortunately.
I know you can't speak for the mayor. I understand that.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
I can't speak for the mayor, but again, I think it's from us. This is, and look, I keep on saying this on the way out before I was selected to be CAO. When I've been leading for the last 200 days, it's not through the lens of politics. It's through the lens of, hey, let's get this all right. So again, from my perspective, we have a responsibility. You have a new council with three new members. You want to give everybody the tools that they need to be successful and to get started in the right way. And again, as you pointed out, this probably is not going to fill the hole, but it potentially prevents the hole from getting any deeper. And why not do something like that just as a fail-safe? And I guess, too, what I struggle, and look, I've had many friends ask me about it over the last week after they've heard about the veto, is what's the harm in it? Other than the fact the mayor identified an emergency potentially happening, which of course creates a different set of circumstances, there seems to be very little downside to the city overall by operating under this regime.
And you are responsible. I mean, these are safeguards that were put in, not safeguards, but restrictions that were put in by the state, correct?
Yes. Well, the things that we have to do for the RAN, for the Revenue Anticipatory Note, are guardrails, both put in by the state and by the bank, too. I mean, they're both. So We have both things that we have to adhere to, which is the bank has certain requirements and the state certainly does. And look, Tommy, I think part of it, too, as I'm talking out loud with you here, is we also have to show the state and others that we're doing things with financial discipline and operational excellence. And I think, again, trying to show Baton Rouge and others that we're taking a deep breath, we're trying to get our finances in order, we're developing, as you and I've talked about many times, short, mid, long-term plans. And this just feels like a good way to not only show that this is the type of thing that people around the state, and particularly for those who are watching at the Capitol, say the city's operating responsibly.
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. I want to talk to you about what it's likely to look like after January 12th when your role and the new council takes over, new mayor takes over, et cetera. 7:50, 10 till 8, traffic now, WWL. 7:55, 5 till 8, Tommy Tucker on this Friday morning, January 2nd, back with Joe Geruso, New Orleans City Council member, soon to be CAO. So, Joe, what happens after January 12th? What are the priorities? How do you go about doing your job? What does the council do? What is the mayor going to do? What's government going to look like? Jump in where you feel comfortable.
Well, I mean, look, I think for me, it's a change in the two senses. Number one, I've been the mayor's colleague for the last 8 years. Now she's the boss. So my job is to execute what she was elected to do. And I think a lot of it, Tommy, honestly, is normalizing relationships. One of the things we keep on hearing from people inside and outside the building is about communication and getting hold of people and how decisions are made. And look, I think it's this balance of trying to do two or three things, which is restore the financial footing of the city, making sure basic quality of life needs are being addressed, and also improving morale, both internally and outside as well. And I think all of those things are important and the things that we're going to work very hard on to make sure that's happening under the Moreno administration.
Was it you I had the conversation with about putting everybody in the same room or having meetings between departments where everybody was together so that you can't trash this one behind this one's back or that one behind that one's back or say they were going to do that or she was going to do that or he was going to do that, get everybody together in the same room. So it's like, well, let's see who's doing what here. Was that you?
That's right. I think we probably had that conversation along the way, if not publicly, certainly privately. But yes, the answer is yes. And I've told people maybe by March or April, you'll be tired of communicating with me because you think it's too much. And that's okay to start. But the important part early on is making sure everybody knows what the vision is, how that's going to be executed, who's responsible, and that there's going to be accountability, too. The other thing, too, Tommy, I keep on telling my team is we are going to make mistakes, right? This is not going to be perfection, but it's about how you address those mistakes, own the mistakes, fix the mistakes, and don't repeat them again. So I don't want people to feel like they're operating on a tightrope without a net. It's we're going to work hard, we're going to work fast, we're going to work with urgency, we're going to work with purpose, and then if something happens, you fix it and move on to the next thing.
What can people in New Orleans realistically expect to change after January 12th or within a time frame after that?
Well, the mayor-elect is going to lay out some plans in pretty short order, so I don't want to steal her thunder.
Okay.
But in short order, it's about working with more urgency, being able to see things and identify what those things are and talking about them and producing on them. So it's, and again, it is the known things that mayor-elect campaigned on and residents talk about. So I don't think there'll be any major surprises here.
Any final thoughts, Joe?
I just look forward to finishing my term. And obviously it's been an honor to represent the people of District A in the city of New Orleans, and look forward to working with the council, the mayor, and the people of New Orleans again, beginning on the 12th.
Thank you, sir. Have a good new year.
Same to you.
Appreciate it. We'll talk to you again, I'm sure. We come back, we're going to talk to Mike Dettelier, WWL NFL analyst, co-host of Sports Talk. We'll preview the Saints-Falcons game. Also talk about Tyler Shuck and more. Then we're going to talk to John Curatola. He's a Samuel Zemurray Stone senior historian at the National World War II Museum and a retired U.S. Marine. We've talked about fighting tigers. We're going to talk about the flying tigers. Claire Chennault went to LSU. He helped fight Japanese forces in World War II. We're going to talk with Dr. John Curatola from the National World War II Museum about Claire Chennault and his fighting tigers, flying tigers, but they were also fighting tigers. And we'll talk to Rafael Goyeneche about crime. And we'll wrap it up talking about Tulane University. Did you know they have over 8 million fish in old World War II bunkers? Talk about something different. We'll talk to him about that. A lot coming up. Stay with us on this January 2nd, second day of 2026. Tommy Tucker back in a flash on WWL.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.